partnership of Advocate Bro Men and OSF Healthcare, offering the latest technology and diagnostic services and cancer treatments, along with time-honored traditions in supportive care. Located at 407 East Verdon in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In the 1970s, Illinois played a pivotal role in the defeat of an equal rights amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It was one of the final three states needed to ratify the amendment, and it was the only northern state that failed to approve it. Now advocates have resurrected the fight. It takes 38 states to approve a constitutional amendment, and currently only two more states are needed to ratify the ERA. Illinois is once again in the spotlight as advocates nationwide look to what Illinois will do. Sally Pancrazio is co-chair of local efforts to win support for the ERA. She says an equal rights amendment is not merely symbolic and not only a women's issue, but a necessary measure to assure equality under the law for both sexes.
The Equal Rights Amendment guarantees that men and women will have equal rights under the law. The United States is one of seven countries on our globe that does not have such a constitutional guarantee.
Why is it important to have an equal rights amendment that covers gender or covers women when people would say, well, we have the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law. We had a Civil Rights Act of 1964, which also prohibited discrimination. So what does the Equal Rights Amendment do if we have these other protections?
Supreme Court Judge Ginsburg has been trying to use the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Amendment.
Ruth Ginsburg.
Ruth Ginsburg, yes, to assure that men and women have equal rights. However, the rest of the court has not agreed with her. And in fact, Supreme Court Justice Scalia, before he passed away, of course.
Antonin Scalia, yeah, who passed away last year.
He said that the United States Constitution neither requires discrimination nor prohibits it. The Civil Rights Act, of course, is a federal law, which assures that there'll be equal protection regarding race, ethnicity, national origin, and a couple of other categories, but it does not include gender. But it also does not apply to men, and there are reasons for men supporting the Equal Rights Amendment as well.
What are some of those reasons?
First of all, men are less likely to get custody of their children in divorce cases. In fact, for decades, women, regardless of their ability to provide good custodial care, were awarded that. Second, a child that's born to unwed parents is less likely to gain American citizenship if the mother is not American.
So there are protections for men in an equal rights amendment as well.
Absolutely.
There may be people who remember all the publicity about the Equal Rights Amendment in the 70s. Why did it fail at that time?
Well, first of all, it was successful in 35 states when we needed 38. It did fail in Illinois. We were the only northern state that in which the Equal Rights Amendment did not pass. I think it's important to remember the context of the times. At that time, the Illinois legislature was facing much criticism because it was a northern state. It was the land of Lincoln. And yet, the Equal Rights Amendment would pass in the House one year and pass in the Senate the next, but never in the same legislative session, which was required. And as the deadline approached, there was folks chaining, women chaining themselves to statues and the places in the Capitol. There were peaceful and nonviolent marches.
These women were proponents.
Absolutely.
Of the ERA.
That is correct. So there was much disarray. There was another spokesperson, an opponent, two major opponents relative to the Equal Rights Amendment. One was Phyllis Schlafly.
Phyllis Schlafly. Yes.
A very successful, articulate, intelligent woman from Alton. She had six children. She was wealthy. And she had been a spokesperson for the very conservative campaigns previous to that time. She was also Catholic, and about a third of the members of at least the House were also practicing Catholics. Officials in the Catholic Church came out against the Equal Rights Amendment. And there was a mingling of what the Equal Rights Amendment meant. And for those folks, the connection for reproductive rights and equal rights and public-funded daycare for working women who were at that time returning to work in greater numbers than ever before, or since World War II anyway, those issues got lumped together. And Phyllis Schlafly, I believe, it's in my opinion, found herself the leader of a faction of concerned women who stayed at home, did not go to work, who felt that traditional marriage would be threatened by the Equal Rights Amendment, and that there would be abortion on demand, that children would be put into communal schools at a very young age. So all those issues got mixed up together. And even today we hear that reproductive rights gets connected to the Equal Rights Amendment. There are other pieces of legislation that do deal with reproductive rights. The Equal Rights Amendment does not.
Well, interestingly enough, Phyllis Schlafly was worried about marriage equality, same-sex marriage. She was worried about abortion rights. She was worried about women serving in the military, and now we have all that.
Societies change, cultures change, believing that people did have choices rather than being a function of that biology was destiny, that our roles were predestined for us. And she played on that very well.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with Sally Pancrazio, who is a co-chair of the local efforts to get an Equal Rights Amendment passed for the U.S. Constitution. Let's go back to the nuts and bolts of this. We should explain that in order for an amendment to enter the Constitution, a new amendment, you do have to have ratification by 38 states. Where do we stand now in terms of how many states still need to ratify it? And is the clock still ticking? Do we pick up where we left off, or do we have to start anew?
Those are two questions. Let me start with the numbers first. First of all, Nevada recently passed the Equal Rights Amendment. I believe it was in April or March. They had, in the last election, their legislature became 40% female. And amazingly enough, why do women want the Equal Rights Amendment? They know what equal pay for equal work means. They understand choices and opportunities. In any case, Nevada passed it, so that left two states. There was a discussion on at the national level about resurrecting this. People should know that the first Equal Rights Amendment was proposed in 1923, 3 years after women got suffrage, by Susan B. Anthony's nephew, in fact. It didn't go anywhere, but it was in 1972, both the Republicans and the Democrats, their party platforms, included the Equal Rights Amendment. There was a decision about, do we start all over, or do we, in fact, just pick up with a three-state strategy? With the prevailing view was, we continue on. And there's been a history of this. In fact, that the 27th Amendment to the Constitution, which folks probably don't remember, says that Congress cannot raise its own pay while it's sitting in Congress. That was submitted 200 years before it was ratified. So back to the other question you had. There's been an increased emphasis on Illinois, and so there's a state ERA group, and our coalition here in Bloomington Normal is very strong. It's made of about 7 or 8 organizations who all have gender equity as a major interest and concern. And there are several other groups that are pending. There are members of groups whose organizations are nonpartisan, whose members are actively involved, but their organizations cannot be because of their nonpartisanship.
Well, let's go back to the count. It looks like Illinois is pivotal in all of this. How many states have ratified it at this point, and how many still remain that have to be ratified? And Illinois is one that remains that has to ratify it.
That is correct. There are 36 out of the 38 who have now ratified the Equal Rights Amendment. So we need two more states.
So it comes down to Illinois and
We had hoped for North Carolina, but their legislators refused to let it get out of committee. If Illinois passes, there's quite a bit of interest in Virginia and Florida. Virginia is a particular interest because it, too, has an equal rights provision within its state constitution, and they have shown interest. So once Illinois passes, and I'm hopeful it will do the right thing this time, then all eyes will focus on probably Virginia.
What specifically do you think an equal rights amendment will change? Because so much has happened just in a societal sense since the 70s. So many things that women were interested in seeing in the 70s, that it's come to pass.
Well, first of all, women on average make 77 cents to men's $1. That's up, by the way, 20 cents from 45 years ago. So essentially, we got a 20 cents raise.
only took four decades for that 20 cent raise.
Exactly. So equal pay for equal work. But having a constitutional amendment also assures guarantees across the states. We have a highly more mobile society today than even in the 1970s, and laws different across the states. With a constitutional amendment, which has enormous amounts of stability and endurance, that provides that bedrock of equality for both men and women. In addition to equal pay for equal work, right now there's we mentioned the differences relative to men. I think I can't remember if I mentioned family leave, but in some states they do provide that. That would assure if the state provides family leave for mothers have adopted or if they've given birth, then fathers would have that opportunity as well. For women, in terms of promotions, men are 30% more likely to get a promotion than a woman is. And many workplaces are still cultured and designed as workplaces for men. That would change as well. Insurance policies cost more for women than for men. A lot of personal services cost more for women than men. That would likely change. You mentioned that society changed without the law, and that's clearly what will happen in the next 30 or 40 years. In fact, Thomas Jefferson, a quotation of his, is etched on the walls of the Jefferson Memorial, and I won't read it to you, but in essence it says that he did not condone the changing of laws and the changing of the Constitution. But he recognized that society changes, that knowledge is gained, that wisdom is obtained, and that our institutions and our Constitution must adjust to these changes.
Sally, how are people locally gearing up for support of the ERA or opposition to it? What's happening locally?
I've seen nothing but support. That doesn't mean there isn't opposition, but I've seen nothing but support. In fact, we're having a kickoff celebration this coming Thursday at the Hyatt on the rooftop, 7 to 9, as a beginning. The purpose of that activity and ones that will follow are to raise awareness. 80% of the people think we already have equal rights between men and women. And so this is to raise awareness. And the second objective is to communicate, put pressure on, if you will, our four local legislators, all Republicans, who we want to vote yes when the Equal Rights Amendment appears in the House and in the Senate in the Illinois legislature.
What kind of response have you gotten from the four local legislators thus far?
On roll call votes and votes that had the words ERA in the past, they've all voted no. We have been in to see at least two of them, and they expressed a great deal of interest, gave us much respect, and interest in obtaining more information. The third one is out of town, but we will be reaching out to that individual. The fourth individual essentially indicated that it was not something that he would vote for. We need Republican votes. We need this to be a bipartisan effort. To that end, our co-chair is a much beloved Republican prominent woman. Her name is Joanne Maitland, the wife of former Senator John Maitland. And we're just ecstatic that she is our honorary chair for our coalition.
Sally Pancrazio is the former dean of the College of Education at Illinois State University, and she is helping to spearhead the efforts to pass an equal rights amendment. Thank you so much, Sally.
Thank you, Judy, for your interest.
I'm Judy Valente.
A kickoff event to raise awareness of the ERA will take place Thursday from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Hyatt Place Hotel in Uptown Normal. The event includes presentations by speakers, musical performances, and refreshments. Tickets are $30, and there's more information at the website, blownoforera.org. It's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Coming up, get an update from the admin for Facebook.com/BloomingtonNormal restaurant scene. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. Farm to still is a term used to mean the distiller controls all stages of production. In business terms, complete vertical integration. Jamie Walker is a keynote speaker at the Illinois Farm Bureau Conference in Uptown Normal today. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, he says farm to still is not the term he uses for his DeKalb area distillery, Whiskey Acres.
What we say here is seed to spirit. We control the entire process from the time the seed is planted in the ground until it's grown, harvested, mashed, fermented, distilled, aged, and bottled, all right here on the fifth generation family farm.
There are two obvious questions to ask, one about the quality control of the process because of that framework, and the other one about costs. How would you address both of how those factors are affected by your approach?
Well, first, from a quality control standpoint, we're very proud of the high-level premium product that we make here, not only in itself, but manufacturer of the spirit. Our hands touch the process the entire way through, and most distilleries cannot say that. We are one of the very few distilleries in the United States that can make the claim that we control that entire process from the growing of the grain all the way through the spirit manufacture. In fact, we're only the second certified farm distillery in the U.S., so that's a big part of our quality control. And what was the second part of your question?
Cost.
Cost. From a cost perspective, you know, it makes some things more affordable. Obviously, our input costs for the feedstock for the distillery, the grain itself, because we're an entirely vertically integrated organization, that has lessened or lowered our feedstock costs. But then again, because of the intensive nature of the handmade process that we're doing here, crafting things in batches of relatively small quantities compared to, say, a Maker's Mark or a Jim Beam, that just from an economies of scale standpoint increases the cost. So there's a bit of a trade-off.
Why should Northern Illinois, Sycamore, DeKalb, Rockford area be a distillery hotspot as opposed to the Bourbon Trail in Kentucky?
You know, it's interesting. People, when they think of bourbon, oftentimes think of Kentucky. It is true that bourbon is a product that is unique to the United States. So bourbon can only be manufactured under international trade rules in the United States. But what surprises most people is to learn that it actually was not Kentucky, but Illinois. Illinois was the number one producer of bourbon in the United States before Prohibition. After Prohibition, many of the distilleries did not survive the Prohibition era in Illinois. Many of them were based in the Peoria area and did not reopen. So we ceded that number one position to Kentucky at that time. But truly, we produce some of the best corn in the world here in Illinois. And as we say on every bottle that we make, great whiskey isn't made, it's grown. And we grow some of the best corn in the world.
Before the income tax and before Prohibition, alcohol provided much of the revenue of the federal government, and the Peoria area was a big part of that income generation for the government. Do you think that that is ever going to be a factor again, that sort of revenue from the alcohol industry for local governments or for state or for federals?
I would answer the question in the affirmative because it's ongoing. As you stated, at one time the main source of revenue for the federal government was alcohol excise tax. It was the instigator of what was called the Whiskey Rebellion. Subsequently, over the years, we've obviously introduced a number of taxes on business and individuals, but the excise tax for alcohol production remains quite strong. In fact, it is our single biggest cost in every bottle that we currently make. So even today, the excise tax at both the federal and the state level amounts to a very high amount of revenue for the government. It is why we're so heavily regulated by the government agencies to make sure we're on the up and up, not skimming anything off. And your listeners may be surprised to know that our tax bill runs about $30,000 per month in generated excise tax revenue to the state and federal levels.
Goodness.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So are we to discern anything about your overall revenue based on that one tax bill?
I don't know if that's fair to say, but we do produce a fair bit of hooch. We manufacture here between 70 and 75,000 bottles a year, the tax revenue in every bottle is between $4 and $5. It depends a little bit on the amount of alcohol or the proof in every bottle.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Jamie Walter of the Whiskey Acres Distillery in Northern Illinois. He's a keynote speaker at the Illinois Farm Bureau Assembly in Normal this week. We had the craft beer movement years ago that has, by some accounts, peaked, although it's still growing substantially. And brown spirits came along and started growing as well. What's the trend line, and where do you expect your sector to peak?
Yeah, so we did a lot of work on this before we decided to enter the market. This was not just a pipe dream that we had one day and decided to wake up and make booze. We were very calculated in our analysis. And when we did that analysis back in about 2011 and 12, and what we saw was a trend in the industry toward more craft production. Certainly, we could look at craft beer as a bit of a benchmark for us to see the rapid growth in that industry. And what we found, and the research has found, is that many people that gravitated toward craft beer subsequently also gravitate toward craft spirits of various sorts. When we started looking at the craft spirits industry and seeing its rapid rise, and mind you, in about 2000, the year 2000, there were roughly 20 or so craft distilleries in the entire United States. By the time that we opened our doors in 2014, there were approximately 600 or 700 of us, and that has again doubled since that time. So today there's 1,300 craft distilleries, and while that seems like a lot, you could put all of us together and our volume wouldn't equate to the amount of spirits that someone like a Jim Beam produces. So, you know, there's great room for growth in volume. Bourbon and brown spirits in general are the fastest growing segment of the spirits industry globally. And so customer demand is very high, both domestically and especially abroad as well.
Is it a boutique kind of purchase, or is it going to be a mainstay for consumers?
Yes and no. So I would say, as a general rule, craft spirits, are probably at first a little bit of a boutique in the sense that they are generally premium priced, and they are oftentimes harder to acquire, harder to find. For example, we are currently only distributed in the state of Illinois. So our customers that might purchase us from outside the state today have to look long and hard in order to find the product and find a seller here in the state of Illinois that is willing to, say, ship a product. Eventually, we will be more widespread. We will be in other states. But because of the price point, it certainly is a bit of a boutique. However, just like craft beer, eventually, as the consumer palate develops, they have a preference that they're willing to pay for that, and will buy it on a more regular basis. And that seems to be especially true within the younger millennial generation. They seem to put a premium on not just the product itself, but the backstory and the transparency of the production process, which are all things that we bring to the table.
Is that something that can be baked into a culture going forward? Are these millennials going to maintain that preference throughout their lives, or how fast do trends change?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know the specific answer to that. I would say that, if we use craft beer as a bit of a benchmark, that industry has had tremendous momentum for upwards of 25 to 30 years now. So I don't think we can say it's a fad. I would say that probably is going to hold true in the spirits industry in general. However, we do see things wax and wane in certain categories. For example, there was quite a bit of flash with white whiskey back not too long ago, and we're already seeing fair reductions in the demand for those kinds of products.
Part of the attraction of white whiskey, though, as a marketing point, is that it takes a while to bring a bourbon to market because it needs aging, and white whiskey is not doesn't have that limitation.
That's absolutely true, and that's probably part of the reason why it's losing a little luster, is there's a greater supply of it today on the market. Most of the big boys didn't have an interest in making a white whiskey, so white whiskeys were generally produced by small craft distillers that were trying to generate cash flow in the near term while they waited for the rest of their spirits to come of age. So, as we get so many more craft distillers, new craft distillers on the market, you see a lot more of those white spirits. Now, you also see a lot of vodka. Those are things that most of us, including ourselves, have dabbled in, and even in the case of vodka, continue to produce some of. But by and large, I think the real growth, the real staying power in the industry is the brown spirits. And from a selfish standpoint, I will also say that it does create those barriers of entry, create a little bit of a moat around the well-capitalized and well-run distilleries like our own.
Where is the market going to come from as this sector matures? Is it going to be a local market? Is it going to be a tourism market? Is it going to be a regional distribution? Is there a network of stores that cater to craft distilling movement?
There's basically, within the craft model, I see really three different functioning business plans, and the first is the purely local. There are more of those hobby distillers, the very small distillers that produce solely for their own gift shop. They may have a tasting room or a gift shop on their property, and they produce for a very local market with maybe few, if any, other additional retail facilities besides their own distillery. That is certainly one model. Another model is to try to get big quick. You see some distilleries, I'll give you an example, like a Tito's, that started as craft at one time, but then quickly as they grew have tried to capitalize on a much larger distribution footprint, and that is their bread and butter today. And then you've got people kind of somewhere in the middle like us that find that a significant portion of our revenue and a significant portion of our market exposure comes from our interactions in the tasting room and in the physical location of our property. So having guests come here and experience our brand firsthand and have a cocktail on our cocktail patio, take a tour, buy a T-shirt and perhaps a couple bottles to go home, is a significant driver of revenue. And we get people that come from not only the Chicago and Chicago suburban market, but in a surprising number of visitors that come from an excess of 100 to 150 miles away. So that's a big piece of our pie. However, distribution is as well. We're distributed in over 550 locations now in Illinois. And in the coming months and years, as we have more product that is mature, we expect that we will begin entering other states around the U.S.
Jamie Walter is the CEO of Whiskey Acres Distillery in the DeKalb area. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Walter is a keynote speaker this afternoon at an Illinois Farm Bureau conference in Uptown Normal. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington Normal is known nationally as an area where people like to dine out a lot, and that's inspiring a rash of entries into the restaurant market. Larry Carius writes about area restaurants for the Bloomington Normal Restaurant Scene Facebook page. Charlie Schlenker also has that interview.
What us old-timers remember as Brantville, that's now called Morrissey Crossing, there's going to be a building that's going to have three spaces, two of which are going to be food. One is the Donut Experiment. Ashley Alexander, who is from the McLean, Atlanta area, when she and her husband were vacationing in Florida, they found a place down there that was called the Donut Experiment, and they absolutely loved it. So when she got home, she contacted the owner, and it's taken a year or two, but she's going to be opening that as soon as the building is built. And the interesting thing that she said is that you select your own donut toppings. When you walk into the place, they will hand you like a little menu where you'll just mark what kind of donut that you want, and then you mark the toppings, and as it goes through the process, you can actually watch your donut being made. So it's something new. I haven't seen one of these.
Customized donuts.
Absolutely.
Right. I hear there's another coffee option for Uptown Normal.
Yes, and when I posted that, that became a very interesting post. Starbucks is going in to the Hyatt, and something I didn't know when the Hyatt was built, there's kind of a hidden room which has a door to the sidewalk that when it was built, it was planned for a coffee shop. I think it'll hold about 30 or 40 people. It created quite a controversy because we've got several locally owned coffee shops down there that are very popular. They have their supporters, and there were a lot of people not real happy that Starbucks was coming to Uptown Normal.
So how many coffee shops can Uptown support?
That we're going to find out.
There's Coffee House, there's Coffee Hound, there's the Garlic Press, and now Starbucks. What's happening with the former Wildberries location out by the shops at College Hills?
I was the one that broke the story that the original Pancake House is going to be going in there. There is one building planned for that place. There are going to be two businesses in it. The original Pancake House will be taking up a little more than half of the building. I've not heard who is going in the other half. For the old-timers around town, this is the second time there's been the original Pancake House. Corner of Washington and Veterans, there was a hotel, I believe the Regal 8 there, and there was a restaurant there, which was the original Pancake House. State Farm purchased that property many, many, many years ago, demolished everything. So I would say, I would guess maybe, 20 years later, 25 years later, we're having the original Pancake House come back to Bloomington.
And since we're on reuses of former places, what about the Pizza Hut location on North Main in Normal?
I'm looking forward to that place. It's called Zen, Z-E-N. He's going to be offering the way he described it to me. When you walk into the establishment, there will be two so-called lines. You can either go into the line, which I describe as kind of a flat-top grill line, where you pick your ingredients. At the end of the line, there's a Mongolian barbecue, and they will cook your hibachi foods similar to what Flat Top does. But the one that I'm looking forward to, he has what he calls the sushi bowl line, and I personally have not seen one of these. He said that they're very, very popular in California, New York City. And when you go through the line, you select your sushi bowl ingredients, which are all ready to eat, whether they're cooked or uncooked, that's a ready to eat. And I guess you have your rice and your lettuce and all the other ingredients. So you select your ingredients and you make your own sushi bowl.
Now, there is a sushi bowl on the menu at Anju Above, but you don't get to select. It's what the chef provides.
Orient Gourmet also has a sushi bowl. But to the best of my knowledge, this will be the first one where you can actually select the ingredients.
So that's coming this fall. There's another Mongolian grill going in. Where is that?
That is Huhat, the development where Best Buy is located. Two doors down from Jewel Food. I have never seen a Huhat. It's one of those that has one of the huge Mongolian grill in the middle of the facility.
How big was the announcement that Giordano's was coming?
Huge. I guess I've been doing this for 5 years now, and it broke every record that I've had. I knew it was going to be popular. I just did not know how popular it could be. And frankly, Charlie, I did not know that I could do a Facebook post that would attract that much attention. It was just truly, truly amazing.
When are they coming in?
I think that they are looking at late fall. And this is going to be located in the former Qdoba's location. One of the controversies about Giordano's coming into town was not that Giordano's was coming, but that many people agreed that the location was very, very surprising. And this is the building north of Biagi's. It's not the best street for getting on GE Road. But then, as somebody said, Biagi's has been very successful in that location. So why can't Giordano's?
It's somewhat difficult for people in Bloomington Normal to get gluten-free food. But there's a new place coming that could help that picture.
I had never met Christopher Golovitzer before. He is going to open the night shop in the former Main Street Grill location in downtown Bloomington. Christopher looks at the world just a little bit differently. He has gone in and he's gutted the dining room. People that are familiar with the Main Street Grill will remember the Island Bar. That is gone. But what I really found interesting, Christopher calls himself a foodie, and he's going to be serving, I think, what he called upscale bar food. Well, that the upscale bar food is going to include several gluten-free items. And when we talked about that and he told me he's going to have gluten-free, I was a little surprised. I don't see a lot of bars having gluten-free items. So I asked him why he was going to do it. And he said, well, it was just purely from a business standpoint that gluten-free has become very popular. He does not know any other bars around town that serve the gluten-free food. He has an interest in gluten-free food. So we're going to see a bar with an upscale bar menu with several gluten-free menu items.
What is a muffler man?
That's a good question. And if the listeners want to drive out by Carl's Ice Cream on West College, they'll find out what a muffler man is. It is a generic term for the roadside giants that you see occasionally in town. These became very popular in the 1940s and 50s on Route 66. Wade at Carl's, he had an interest in the roadside giants. He wanted to put one in, which would go along with the theme of his ice cream. There's only one person in the country who makes these muffler men. Now, why did they call them muffler men? On Route 66, you would generally see them holding a muffler. they were found usually only at muffler shops. Well, as they became more popular, you might see one that they called the soda jerk, and they had several other themes. But since they started out as a muffler man, they're generally just referred to as muffler man. But when you go past Carl's, his model, which was made in Virginia, it's hollow fiberglass, 15 foot tall. It came to Normal in one piece in an enclosed trailer. Wade and a couple friends, they poured a concrete base and mounted him. Wade told me he's amazed himself at the number of families that will stop by. They will have their picture taken with the muffler man. The Route 66 people, even though it's a little off the beaten track, they're people that travel the country finding muffler man. It's just really a neat thing to see out there.
Bloomington Normal has a really high concentration of restaurants, a very high per capita rate compared to the Midwest and getting up there in the nation. Can all of these new restaurants that have been planned survive?
That's an excellent question. We had four restaurant closures in maybe the last two or three months. We've had 14 places open. Now, besides the 14 places that open, we have 10 that are planned. So we had four places close in, say, the last 4 months. We have 25 places that have opened or have been announced to open.
It's a tough business already.
It's a very tough business, and it's going to get tougher.
Larry Karius is the man behind the Bloomington Normal restaurant scene Facebook page. He spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Karius notes that a Central Illinois favorite, the Bärenstube in Gibson City, is for sale after 26 years. The owners are moving to Florida, but hope to find someone to continue the tradition. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Flowering crab trees are a popular landscape plant that come with a tendency to be susceptible to a host of problems, including stress. Patrick Murphy has more on this edition of GLT's Grow.
It's not just people who react poorly to stress. Trees can, too. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, Marilyn from Normal wonders if her ailing flowering crab tree is actually suffering from stress. It was planted last year. She says it looked good until about a month ago when all the leaves started turning red and brown. She assumes it was under some sort of stress. She says they watered profusely and some of the leaves turned green. So she wants to know if you think it was stress and it needs continuing watering, or could there be a disease in there as well? Because as we both know, flowering crabs are susceptible to disease.
They can be finicky.
Yes.
And crab apple trees are a really popular flowering ornamental. You see tons of them in some neighborhoods and even in some campuses, whether it's a corporate campus or an education campus. They're so common and their population is so high that sometimes it's too much.
Mm.
But that's really not the issue in this case with Marilyn's tree. Stress comes in many forms on trees and woody plants and all plants for that matter. But the crab apple has a full fist full of problems. So I count five fingers on my fist and there's five major things that
Great.
The crab apples deal with. And powdery mildew, fire blight, apple scab, cedar apple rust, fungal leaf spot. These are all common with crab apples, especially long-standing existing crab apples. They're less diverse than the new crab apple that you can buy nowadays.
Well, she just planted this a year ago, so does that give her a leg up on that?
It could, because there are a lot of varieties that are resistant to the common diseases. But a lot of times, in keeping with our, we bang this drum a lot here at Grow, right tree, right place.
Mm-hmm.
So you plant a crab apple in a spot that it's in full sun and only to have a tree grow and throw it in shade later.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that's really common, but it's easy to avoid. And that's one of the ways to mitigate and control diseases is to pick the right tree and put it in the right place. But it's hard to do in a lot of cases, and we can't win them all. So if you know when it comes to the crab apples, there are a couple things that we can all do that don't require specialization and a great deal of expense. And one of those things is to keep these crab apples clean. So if a crab apple has leaf spot and all the leaves fall to the ground, you should try and collect them with your mulching mower or rake them up with a leaf rake and dispose of them in your compost or burn them if it's legal and safe to do so.
Uh-huh.
Because in many cases, when it comes to like the cedar apple rust, the apple scab, and the fungal leaf spot,
mm-hmm.
they can come right back if you don't clean the mess up that they have created.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, we're talking about Marilyn's crab tree. You know what I thought was weird was the fact that she said the leaves turn not just brown, but red.
Okay.
That was weird.
Yeah, and so that might be a type of crabapple cultivar that has a red fall color, because there are many.
Oh.
And that's another sign that there is something of some kind of a problem or some kind of stress there.
Okay.
So, and also Marilyn indicated that they water it a lot.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Oh, good.
But it's best to water your trees deeply and infrequently rather than
every single day?
Light little waterings frequently, which mm-hmm. causes the roots to not have to seek out water, and you kind of develop a weak plant that way.
Ah.
And in that case, if the plant's just weak because it's a newer planting with less than 2 years old, this can happen just because it's so doggone hot out. So the heat reflects off the ground, it goes into the tree. The juvenile leaves that haven't hardened off or developed all the way yet, they're really susceptible.
Wow.
And they show the signs of that heat stress from reflective heat that comes off the ground or off of other buildings, things like that. It's really, really common. Now, there's an expression that goes with fruit trees that you should be able to throw your hat through the middle of a fruit tree, and that's true for crab apples too. So even though we're not making applejack and other things out of those little tiny apples,
mm-hmm.
it's still a fruit tree. So in the winter, if you have a picture of what the tree looks like when it's growing, or you put little ribbons or marker spots on the less useful branches, and those are branches called water sprouts and suckers.
Uh-huh.
They grow off the top of other branches and usually towards the inside of the tree. And they kind of break up the symmetry and the natural architecture of the tree's crown. So if you look at that crab apple in the winter, you can see all these straight line branches that are coming off the tops of other productive branches, and they're always seeking the inside of the tree. Once college football weather starts up, put your jacket on and go out and prune those out. And if it's a brand new tree and you don't have them, don't prune them.
All right.
Because if you don't have them, you don't have to prune them. But for a lot of people, that I see crab apples from my car driving to and from campus every day, and it's mm-hmm. really common. And a lot of times it's no issue. But if there are other stress factors there that could cause the apple scab, things like that. The apple scab is a host in cedar trees.
Mm-hmm.
So the cedar tree down the street can give your crab apple apple scab.
Can you treat for apple scab?
You can. Apple scab, it won't kill the tree, but if there's other problems, it could kind of lead it to its final senescence. That's the term referring to a woody plant dying.
Dear.
Death by a thousand cuts is usually how that happens.
Mm-hmm.
So the good practices of the dormant pruning that we talked about, and then as you encounter dead wood during the growing season, remove that, dispose of that. Proper mulching and watering at the ground level are important. Well, you're not going to throw mulch up in the tree. Just want to make that clear, right? Right. But and then once you've done that, all you can do is the hygiene by keeping those infected leaves off the ground while you're still mowing the grass, you know,
mm-hmm.
so a lot of people that are professionally managing crabapple trees, old and new varieties alike, they take the time in late February into the end of March, sometimes even the first couple of weeks of April, it's still cool enough to apply dormant oil. Dormant oil kills a lot of the insects that are a threat to the tree, and sometimes the threat is indirect because insects can spread disease in addition to chomping on the plant.
Uh-huh.
Then there are various fungicides. So if you had a fungal leaf spot in this case, with Marilyn's case, and I'm not saying it's that because I really need to see it to say what the problem is, but fungal leaf spot can be treated with a fungicide. So can powdery mildew. That's very common. Powdery mildew is so common that it doesn't really cause death. It just reduces the attractive appearance of the tree or woody plant.
All right.
And because it's a stress, it makes it more vulnerable to other
It's opening the
declines.
Door.
That's right. So we talk about the horticultural oils a lot. It's because they work. They're safe. They don't bother the bees. That's really important.
Neem oil stinks, but rosemary oil doesn't.
Yeah, and some people actually find the neem oil smell interesting or palatable.
Okay. We'll put that in air quotes.
Yeah, Laura and I aren't those people. But this stuff works. It works, and it helps with lots of other things. So if it's a crab apple, like a Brandywine crab apple that drops lots of crab apples, and they're big, beautiful ones that are actually ornamental in appearance, they look like a tiny apple, they're going to have lots of gnats and flies if they're on the ground. The neem oil and the rosemary oil will take care of that and make those apples on the ground a lot less palatable.
So do you think Maryland stands a chance to keep this thing going?
Absolutely. I think when we're getting questions this time around this year, the heat's been so bad, I just kind of think that it's related to that. And if you don't go crazy with the light daily waterings and just do the deep and frequent waterings every week, 10 days, 12 days, you'll be in great shape.
Okay, Marilyn, thank you so much for your question. Next week, we'll be dealing with hungry critters in a humane way on GLT's Grow. If you've got a gardening question you'd like Murph to take on, and hey, if there's a photo to go with that, just go to our website, wglt.org/grow, fill in the form, send it along to us. That's wglt.org/grow.
Discover more gardening advice from Murph with the Grow Podcast. Download it weekly at iTunes and WGLT.org. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or individual interviews today from Judy Valente, Charlie Schlenker, and Laura Kennedy. WGLT.org is also where you can find contact information to let us know what you think of this show or share your thoughts at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal 89.1 FM and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.